Inside Security Podcast with Martin and Steve Yvette and Little Joe. News Yankee Steve giving weekly updates. Armor guy managing the microphones. Joseph's there and sparkles while the vet's in the airport. Andy Googles Microsoft on his iPhone. A family-friendly bucket full of southern goodness. What will they be ranting about this week?
It's episode 199 of the Southern Fried Security Podcast. My name is Martin Fisher. Glad you could join us tonight. Joining me through the miracle that is IP telephony is my good friend Joseph Ciccoli. Joseph, how are things in your neck of the woods?
Things are great. We're getting kind of a sneak peek at fall up here. So it is the most pleasant second week of August that I think I've ever had.
Yeah, we're starting to feel that down here in Georgia as well. And also joining us, and I'm so excited because I've not had a chance to speak to her in forever, is the always wonderful Yvette Johnson from her secure undisclosed location near some sort of establishment that serves cocktails. Yvette, how are you?
I am fantastic. I am fully recovered from security summer camp.
July was a brutal month for a lot of people.
Yeah, it was, especially me. I traveled a bunch, but I chose it. So
now, not to put you on the spot, but top highlight from security summer camp?
From B-Sides, it was a talk given less about security but more about technology from a guy who is blind and the apps that are available to him. And one specifically goes through his Google Glass and literally can get him from his hotel to a cafe on the strip, gets him through the airport, all through a person who is looking through the Google Glass and can see his surroundings and guide him. It was amazing. Really, really cool talk.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And on your side, Joseph, you have an addition to the family coming shortly.
Yeah, so this will, depending on how the recording schedules works out, there will probably only be a few more episodes before I take a little bit of a break to deal with diapers and crying and stuff like that.
And feeding.
And feeding. Well, I mean, I'm not going to be super involved in that portion, but yeah.
And you will never be happier in your life, trust me.
Great.
So unfortunately, Steve and Andy can't make it tonight, but guys, we're gonna pick up and just keep talking. So Joseph, remind us of where we are.
So we are now in the second part of the series on building a security strategy. We started out with kind of an introduction on what is a security strategy versus what is like a security policy. You know, so how a policy is binding statements versus a security strategy is a thought out plan that is put in place organization-wide. So that's kind of where we went last time. We explained kind of why you want one, what a security strategy is. If you haven't gone back and listened to that, I highly recommend you pause now, jump back over to episode, I believe that's episode 198, which is Building a Security Strategy Part 1. So now we're going to kind of get into Building a Security Strategy Part 2, which starts to answer the question of, how do I make a security policy? And sure. Martin, you've been kind of leading this discussion, so why don't you walk us through kind of your outline, and then we'll kind of get into each of the points.
Sure. So there's, if you remember from those of you who remember long ago when we posted part one, there are really five things that are important to getting a strategy. You know, one is understand the business of your business. You need to know who your stakeholders really are. There's this concept of capability, the algebra is, you know, tech plus services together times process equals the capability. And we're gonna probably have an entire episode to talk about that. And then finally, this understanding that it takes a village to get a security strategy out there. So what we kind of want to do today is break down the first three. We're going to try to understand the business of your business, how to do that, why it's important. We'll talk about understanding who your stakeholders really are. And then finally, we're going to talk a lot about culture, but that's a couple minutes down the road. So the first thing, guys, understanding the business of your business. This is probably going to come to a shock to a lot of the people who listen, is Because if you ask a lot of people at security summer camp or at an ISACA meeting or wherever you are, you know, what industry are you in? Probably 70-80% say information security. The truth is, almost no business is actually in the business of information security. I'd even argue that a lot of the companies that we think of as being security companies aren't actually in the business of information security. They may sell services or products, but the actual doing of the information security is very rarely what they do.
Yeah, this was something that caught me very much off guard when I started in my current position. Up until this point in my career, I had been a security consultant or working in a SOC or something along those lines where, you know, everything I thought lived and, you know, breathed was security is my business. And suddenly I found myself at a large healthcare organization and security is not the business of a healthcare organization. It's not the business of a financial organization. And, you know, Martin, I know you and I have talked about this quite a lot offline, and you have a really good way of putting it. Like, your organization is a healthcare organization as well, and you define – I'm trying to remember, what it is. What is your mission statement or how you explain that?
So, for me, I have the role of information security in a healthcare organization. And if you were to look at the mission statement for my group, you know, mission number one is ensure patient safety. You know, mission number two is ensure quality of patient care. We don't talk about security to get to number three, where we talk about ensuring the confidentiality of sensitive information. That's because I work in healthcare. I'm not a clinician by any stretch of the imagination. I can put Band-Aids on boo-boos, and that's about the extent of my clinician ability. But I work in healthcare. And if I didn't work with that being front of mind, I don't think I'd be successful where I'm at, because I would be working counterculturally. And again, we're going to talk a whole lot about culture. But just remember, folks, very few of you actually work in the business of information security. You have a role, you have a function, and it's tremendously important. I'm not denigrating anyone's job. What I'm saying is you have to understand the reality that you're in a larger organization that very most likely isn't in the business of being secure. Number two, and this is the one where it sounds really easy, but it's actually really hard, is to be able to follow the money. I work for a not-for-profit. That doesn't mean we don't earn money. Almost every organization generates some sort of revenue. There's a methodology or a vocabulary or some way they manage that revenue. When Yvette and I worked together at the airline, we talked about things like CASM and RASM and gauging city pairs, right? And these are things around revenue management. You know, the cost by available seat mile, the revenue by available seat mile. And if you didn't understand how the airline made money, you didn't know where to do the predictions. One of the things that Yvette and I worked on together was the e-commerce site for the airline. Intensely important thing, because so much money comes to the airline through that site. In healthcare, right? It's really important for me to understand, how do we get paid for the things that we do? I need to understand how ICD codes work, and I need to understand how third-party payers work, and I need to understand a load of different things that we do on the revenue management cycle. And I've people that I've gotten to know over the last 6 years who have done a lot to teach me about revenue management and revenue integrity inside of healthcare. You know, I know Yvette most likely, you know, working in startup world. If I know Yvette, we haven't actually talked about this, but if I know Yvette, she has learned how the organization she's at today makes money.
Definitely. Versus being at a large organization where you kind of know how they make money. I mean, you know, generally, like at the airline, I knew how we made money. And it was also very apparent to me every day, because we got those kind of those all hands emails every day. And the very first line on those emails at the airline was our stock price and the price of oil.
Right.
That absolutely drove our business when we were at Airline. Versus a startup, it's so much different. My customers, which are not individual customers versus at the airline, my customers are large organizations.
And I think as a security leader, you have to remember that everyone else in the organization who's a leader cares about money. The marketing guys, they care about making money. The folks in the CFO org, they care about making and tracking money. Believe it or believe me, the CEO cares about making money. And if you can demonstrate as a security leader that you understand where the money comes from and you understand the vocabulary around it and you understand the things that worry leadership about the way your organization makes money, you earn the corporate equivalent of street cred. They're going to take a moment then to listen to you about, because they understand you've got their interests in mind. So when you bring a security strategy out, you've aligned it with the way you make money and you've aligned it with the corporate mission. You've gone a long way to fitting inside the culture and in fitting inside the desires that senior leadership are going to have around just the continuing operation of the organization. The next step there is you've got to understand the decisioning process. And I know there are people going, decisioning, and there's someone probably clawing at their earbuds. What I mean by that is every organization takes decision-making differently. Every organization has a different process, a different cadence, and a different method by which they make decisions, both large and small. Every organization is different into how far down into the organization they push the authority, to make decisions. And you have to understand that. Because if you make a mistake and you try to get people who are either too junior in the organization or laterally too far away from the decision-making point, you're not going to get what you want. Equally bad is trying to get the decision to be made by someone who's way too far up in the organization. So, for example, and I see consultants do this every once in a while. The consultants will say, you need, and oh gosh, this thing, we're going to have to do a podcast on me getting ragey about it, is you'll hear consultants say to a CISO, you need to be briefing the board of directors. Right? And every CISO out there has probably heard that, how do you communicate with the board? Well, in some organizations, the decision process is held at the board level. The board is much more active. They are actively making decisions around corporate strategy and corporate priorities, and it may be appropriate for the CISO to engage with them. Some organizations, on the other hand, the board really isn't, that's not their job. It may be the CEO, it may be the COO, it may be the CIO, it may be someone further down. You've got to identify who that decision maker is and gear what you do to enable them to make the decision that they need to make. That doesn't mean there aren't influencers. And we'll talk more about the stakeholders and influencers in a few minutes. But you got to understand how those decisions are made, because if you address that incorrectly, all those hours and days of effort you put into trying to get a decision brief to who you thought was the right person or you thought was the right process, at best, you simply get to do a do-over. At worst, you've critically damaged your ability to get your strategy out there into the organization. The next thing we want to talk about, and this is something we'll talk about consistently, one of my favorite quotes from Peter Drucker is culture eats strategy for breakfast. Strategy is a wonderful thing. Organizations can live without strategy. Every organization has a culture, every single one. And if you attempt to put forth a strategy that is counter to the culture of the organization, you are almost guaranteed to fail. And Yvette, you and I have talked, just recently and in the past, where in your consulting role, consultants don't necessarily always understand corporate culture. That's not their job. Their job is to come in and say, based on the little bit we know about you, here are some ideas as to what could help you, right? And we're going to do a series on how you work with the consulting. But the idea is that as a CISO or as a security leader, you can take these ideas and this content And then you have to adjust it to fit the lens of culture. And then I know you've seen situations and you've experienced situations where that didn't necessarily happen.
Yeah. And, you know, me going into consulting, I kind of went a little backwards. You know, most people go consulting industry. I went industry consulting. And when I was in consulting, I had a unique perspective because I've worked in large companies. And it was great for me to come in and produce, you know, spend a little bit of time amongst, you know, the teams and seeing their culture and thinking that I had really done a deep dive into it and producing this, you know, magnificent strategy that was just going to save them. But I realized pushing that across the table to people whose culture doesn't support it was the first mistake. That was a big adjustment for me with my peers in consulting, is to remind them, this is great. This sounds great. And I'm sure that when we present this, it's going to look great. But sometimes there's things in this culture that are just not going to support these processes or this strategy overall. And we have to highlight where we think they can get the best bang for their buck, because otherwise we're just creating shelfware for them and they're really not going to be able to see any value. And yeah. It's hard to know. You can't spend 4 weeks at a client and know their strategy. It takes years to learn somebody's culture and what it is. And it was different at the airline. It was different in consulting. Consulting, it has its own culture versus where I'm at now is a startup culture. And, you know, I'm walking in with a lot of consulting background and mature organization background. And that startup mentality sometimes is, as we mature our organization, is a little kicky against maturing because of the culture has not supported that in the past. So it's a very interesting thing to see and to talk about with the decision makers during that process and understanding that business overall, that sometimes their culture just isn't going to support this.
Exactly. I mean, if I had a dollar for every linear foot of binder generated by consultants everywhere that didn't get implemented because of culture, I'd probably own an island in the Caribbean right now and be doing things with umbrellas in them. And sort of related to culture, and this is the last comment for this section, is vocabulary matters. You need to understand the vocabulary that your organization uses, and beg, borrow, steal, leverage, plagiarize, whatever it is you need to effectively communicate to the business. You know, in healthcare, I use a lot of terminology out of epidemiology. I use a lot of clinical terms, and I have to use them correctly. I just can't borrow them willy-nilly. But when I talk to clinicians about our program, you know, we talk about things like sentinel events, and sentinel events have a very specific meaning. And if you, again, once you can demonstrate you understand the vocabulary of your organization, you gain some street cred. So next one we want to talk about is understanding who the stakeholders really are. And this is where a lot of people make mistakes. I know most organizations, there's this formal org chart. It's usually like a series of PowerPoints, which, you know, from the CEO, there's executive VPs. Then within each executive VP area, there's the VPs and the directors and the managers and the supervisors. And then there's the crafty minions who are out there, you know, doing work. That's a fantastic thing to know, and it's a fantastic thing that you have to be aware of. But there are also informal org charts. You know, the CEO may have six direct reports, and they're all equal, but some are more equal than others. Right? To paraphrase a George Orwell thing. Because the informal org chart, once you understand who key influencers are, those people are as important for you to communicate with and for you to have a relationship with as the person who actually signs off on the decision itself. You know, I've been in organizations where you have someone, they may have a title like principal or advisor, or any of these really nondescript little job titles, but nothing gets approved by the CEO without that person saying, yeah, I think it's a good idea. And you can be absolutely certain nothing is going to go past the CFO if their trusted advisor tells them it's a bad idea. The influencers who exist within your informal org chart are incredibly important. And if you ignore them, you're going to fail because you will have disrespected the culture. The culture says these other people are worthy of your respect, and the process demands you consult with them. Don't assume that just because you have an objectively true plan or an objectively perfect plan that you can ignore that. Because one of those people may turn into what I like to think of as the spoiler. And Yvette, we can't name names as much as I'd love to, but you and I have dealt with that. Mm-hmm. So why don't you talk a little bit about the spoiler and how you've dealt with that?
So almost every consulting engagement I had, there was the spoiler. This was the one that hated consultants, thought we knew nothing, and really had no interest in sharing anything about their team or what they did, and spent as little time as they could sharing with us or even working with us. But they were typically important in the organization. And I'm a social introvert, so that shouldn't be a shock to anybody. So when I met my first spoiler, I remember he managed the Unix team. And what I knew about Unix at the time fit in a nimble because I had come from a large Windows environment. And so he recognized that right away and was the spoiler. And instead of, you know, falling apart and just trying to pass him off to somebody else, I made it my mission to, number one, learn as much as I could about Unix that supported me on that project, and that I was going to make the spoiler my friend. So I, you know, on my own, learned Unix and learned as much as I could to not necessarily jump in it all the time every day, but to speak about it in a strategic way, and that I could speak to him in a way when I was asking questions about their team and their processes and how they supported the business. And once he realized that I had done my homework and I had spent some time and that I wasn't just a dumb consultant just wasting his time, he loosened up and our conversations improved. And by the end of that project, he was literally my friend. I mean, at the, you know, my last day there, he thanked me for my hard work. He was appreciative of my team and, you know, said he looked forward to working with me in the future, which for me was huge. But then you go on to the next project and then there's the new spoiler. So you have to, there's one in every organization and they're different at every organization. And you simply just have to learn to adjust. And maybe you're going to win them over and be their bestie, or you're going to walk out of there and they're still going to hate you. But it's a good practice to find them and not let them detract from, you know, your strategy, because they'll do it fast because they don't want to do it. They'll get you out of that strategy business fast.
Exactly. Because what you have to understand with those people like the spoilers and the influencers is they're part of the culture.
Yeah.
Spoilers are effective because they understand how to use the culture to get the outcome they do or don't want. Yeah. And if you're not aware of that, again, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And the last point around stakeholders, and this is sort of an odd one. Don't give a vote or a veto unnecessarily. Now, this is really geared toward the security leaders. A lot of times in our desire to gain consensus around our strategy or around our project, we are willing sometimes to give someone who doesn't deserve or need a vote. And that's simply opening yourself up for them to decide that they want to be a spoiler. Or if you make something conditional on someone's approval that it doesn't need to be, you're actually giving them the ability to veto something. Usually I see this when leaders give a vote or a veto to a consultant. Now, I've got, I wouldn't say I don't have anything against consultants. I love some consultants. But I think there's a, consultants have their place. Consultants, because they're seagulls, they come in, they crap all over everything, and they go back out, they don't get a vote. Of course, again, if they are a key influencer, maybe they do. But an official vote, very rarely, if ever, will a consultant have a vote or a veto. Don't give them one if they don't deserve it or if they don't have to have it. Your steering committee, your whatever phraseology you want to put around those key leaders that you have to gain consensus with, keep that group as small as you can and don't unnecessarily make it larger than it has to be. So kind of wrapping up just this section, I mean, again, culture is the key, and we're going to keep pounding on this for the rest of the strategy episodes that we do, because if you underestimate the power of the culture of your organization, even and especially when you don't like the culture of your organization, it will result in your plan failing, right? Will. There's no way around it. And just in honesty, in talking with people who have deployed strategies successfully and some and people who have struggled with it, the majority of the time that a strategy fails or the strategy's hard is because they're not leveraging the power of the culture themselves and they're trying to fight it. So,
Come on. Strategy harder. Come on.
Hashtag strategizing. next time we'll start talking about capability. We'll talk about crawl, walk, run. And then we'll close out with talking about it takes a village and who needs to be in your village and who needs to be cast out of the city gates. So, Joseph, we didn't think we'd take this long to talk this. I thought, we got less than 20 minutes of content here, and here we are at almost 30 minutes. So I'm thinking we're just about out of time and we need to wrap it up.
Yeah, I think that was a pretty good walkthrough of those points for today.
We will have another episode coming to you probably in a couple of weeks. We appreciate the patience during our hiatus. And, Yvette, were you going to set up a Patreon for your liver?
Yes, I need crowdfunding.
So on behalf of Andy Willingham and Steve Reagan and everybody here at the podcast, good night. We look forward to talking again soon, and stay safe.
Good night.